Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Meet the Professor. This is the day we talk about the management of gastroesophageal cancers with Professor Eric Van Cutsem, Professor of Medicine, Digestive Oncology, University Hospital Leuven in Leuven, Belgium, joining us from around midnight in Belgium here tonight. We have a great faculty for this series. Recently, we did a program with Dr. Enziger, and we'll soon be finishing out the series with Dr. Klempner. We have several other faculty members who participated in a survey that we're going to show you the results in later. As always, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by us, just type them into the chat room and we'll talk about as many of these as we have time. As we do in all the webinars, there's a 1-minute pre-meeting survey for you to take before and after the meeting. If you take that, we'll learn a little bit about you and you'll get a little bit more out of this meeting. We're just coming back, and Dr. Van Cutsem just got back from the big ESMO meeting in Madrid, and we have 3 webinars set up the week of November 7th, focusing on some of the many great papers that were just presented, starting out with gynecologic papers on November 7th, breast cancer, our papers on the 9th, and then we've got a big program on lung cancer, a lot of very, very interesting papers presented at ESMO in non-small cell lung cancer in particular. We're going to finish out this series in the middle of November with Dr. Klempner. Then we'll be heading out, as we do every December, San Antonio Breast Cancer Meeting. We'll be doing 3 satellites there. If you're at San Antonio, drop by. If not, we'll be putting them out live online for you to check out. And then the next day, we'll be hopping over to San Diego. We're doing 4 symposium on December the 8th, 8.5 hours of content on lymphomas, myeloma, and CLL. And again, you can check it out virtually as well. Prior to the pandemic, we did several weekend-long meetings focused on general medical oncologists covering a variety of tumors. We decided to start that up again. So next March, we'll invite you to join us in Miami here for an entire weekend of CME. We know a lot of people end up listening to our programs. If you're into podcasts, check out our Oncology Today series, including a program with Dr. Philip on GI presentations from the recent ASCO meeting. But today we're here to talk about GI cancers, upper GI cancers in particular. We'll be focusing a lot on some of the things that just happened at the ESMO meeting. As always, keep in mind that we will be talking about off-label use of treatments here, but we're really focused on the risk-benefit of newer therapies. And to get to that, as we do in this series, we have a number of oncologists, mostly in community practice, are going to be presenting cases for Dr. Van Cutsem to consider. We're going to start out and just sort of chat a little bit about some of the things that are going on, including what happened at ESMO. Then we'll get into the cases. Then we'll do the investigator survey. And then if we have time, we'll pull some of the talk about some of the papers that Dr. Van Cutsem has done. And we also, as always, have an extensive appendix that's available. If you go in the chat room, you can download it. So, Eric, you know, I'm always into anything that's edutaining. And when I saw this paper, I had to ask you about it. So this was, a commentary on a paper in the Journal of Thoracic Cardiovascular Surgery about metastectomy and colorectal cancer. But what I loved was your take on it, that the authors were on a crusade against metastectomy. And I really loved your comment on that in terms of that. Maybe not the most important issue in the world, but anything you want to say about this sort of playful interchange that went by? I guess it's been going on for a while, that Dr. Treasure is not too excited about metastectomy in the lung. Your editorial kind of says, hey, you know, it's clinically, it's not that difficult, you know, to do this. Any comments?
Yeah, I think it's clear that metastectomy, we don't have randomized trials. That's like for liver metastasis, you don't have trials randomizing patients in clearly resectable disease between not resecting the liver metastasis or resecting the liver metastasis. The same is for lung disease. And then there was a small trial which Dr. Treasure commented on, which didn't show, was not able to show a benefit, but there were so many shortcomings in that trial The message is clearly we should do resection if possible, and there are two criteria. That's the oncological criteria. Of course, a patient with rapid progressive disease, many different metastases, even if they can remove them, may not be an oncological good patient. And then there's a technical aspect. Can the surgeon do an R0 resection in this setting? And even in that commentary, we made a small, not a joke, but a small commentary to the fact that jumping out of a plane with a parachute or no parachute, there have never been trials done that you have to open your parachute. But as we said, Dirk, my colleague surgeon, and myself, Dirk van Amdonk, and myself, we would open the parachute. Tom Treasure does not have the right to open the parachute because there are no trials that demonstrate that you have to open it. So that's a little bit this type of entertaining discussion.
I liked it a lot. And also another paper I saw that you were involved with, that kind of, you know, this whole issue of oligometastatic disease, you hear it in all, you know, all types of solid tumors. But this is a really interesting, what I really like was the graphics that came out of this, where they go from green to pink to dark red based on, you know, what this group, how they evaluated. Here they present a bunch of situations and say, would you use local therapy? You know, for example, a patient with one adrenal med or whatever. And you can, it's just an interesting way to see how a group of people look at different issues. Any comments again on this effort and the whole field of oligometastatic disease and GI cancers?
Yeah, this effort here was a really nice effort. The initiative was taken by our Dutch colleagues, one of the PhD students who did a lot of work on that, to try to understand, because we know that many oncologists or surgeons sometimes are taking out one or two metastases in upper GI cancer, but there is no real guidance. So that's why we try to have, and as on the previous slide were all the different authors, experts from different regions, a different background, to have their ideas. This is not always evidence-based, but this is experience-based, and that's what we all do in oncology. The discussion, the cases that we will discuss in just a moment, there will be also sometimes evidence, sometimes there will be more experience, and that's what we try to do. And because we were so many giving the opinion in this type of Delphi approach with different rounds, they had to find a creative way to represent in a visual way the results, and that's the outcome of this, which gives important data. Just as a definition of oligometastatic disease, we tried to create a definition which was three or less than three metastases when we talk about upper GI cancer. It's different than colorectal cancer. Also there in some consensus papers, we have made definitions of oligometastatic colorectal cancer. Then usually it's set five or less and maximum two different organs in stomach cancer because the biology is different, or in esophageal cancer, it's three within one organ. So there are some differences. And there was a kind of consensus that came out of this, which is quite interesting. And then building on that, you can try to build up some treatment algorithms or treatment recommendations in general.
So I pulled your original presentation at ASCO 2009 of the TOGA trial. We know, I think about 30% of our audience has only been in oncology less than 10 years, so they weren't part of seeing that happen. But really, this is really the first time I think targeted therapy was shown to be effective in GI cancers. And you know, this is only a few years. Remember, this is 2009. 2005 is when the adjuvant trastuzumab papers all of a sudden came out at ASCO. It quickly came into practice. And then just a few years later, you reported this in a metastatic disease. I always love, you know, like cool trial names. And this is one of my favorites over the years. I like GLOW too. That was kind of a good one. I know the slides weren't quite as sophisticated as the ones we're using now, and all the mechanism have gotten a lot different. But a couple of things that I thought was kind of interesting. One was, this is the primary result, you know, the survival benefit, a hazard rate of 0.74. I think the hazard rate was a little bit better, more in the sixes when you restricted it to what we would consider HER2 positive today. But there was that benefit seen. One of the things I thought was interesting, and there's a lot, we're going to talk about zolbetuximab, and you know, zolbetuximab, actually the hazard rate for survival is also very similar to what was reported here when you added trastuzumab. I wanted to get your take on another study, you know, sort of the son or daughter of TOGA maybe, or the granddaughter, this paper here. But before we get into this new concept, I'm just curious if you can reflect back on your experience there with TOGA, the reaction to it, how people responded in terms of taking it up in practice. To me, as I remember it, you know, we'd already been prepped with all the trastuzumab stuff from breast cancer, so people were kind of ready for this. But what were your recollections of that?
Yeah, the TOGA study was indeed, we designed the study, I believe, in 2006 or 5 or 6 around these days. This was a breakthrough because it was the first time in gastric cancer that we saw a benefit on top of chemotherapy, and that we could come with median survivals above 12 months in stomach cancer in a really targeted way. So I remember 15 years ago, there were no targeted agents in stomach cancer as in many other cancers. It was important. That's also the reason why there was only one randomized study. Now with solbituximab that you mentioned, there are two randomized studies. There was one randomized study, which led to the approval in many countries with just one study. Sometimes these days, we would request sometimes a bit more data in this setting, two or one study and then a supportive study. But these days, that was good. There was, however, a different approach in Europe and in the US. In the US, the curve that you've shown with the hazard ratio of 0.74 was in the IHC 3 plus and or FISH positive patients. In Europe, the label was given to a bit of more restricted population with the real stronger HER2 positive patients, which was defined as IHC 3 plus. Or a 2 plus followed by a positive FISH test, which led to a hazard rates of 0.66, I believe, in this setting. And the newer right. studies with some of the new agents, like the one that you show here, zanidatamab, that's also usually most of these new studies are in the so-called stronger HER2 positive population, because HER2 is different in stomach cancer than it is in breast cancer. It's more heterogeneous. There are differences in the basal membrane staining in stomach cancer compared to breast cancer, and it's probably lesser of a driver. That's why in breast cancer, we have seen positive studies with T-DM1, with pertuzumab plus trastuzumab in stomach cancer. The studies of trastuzumab plus pertuzumab plus chemo failed, and also the study with T-DM1 failed, because HER2, although being important in stomach cancer, it's probably a little bit less a driver, or the heterogeneity plays a role in this also.
So I wanted to ask you just briefly to comment on this really cool study here. First of all, zanidatamab, a bispecific that hits two different parts of the HER2, as opposed to, you know, we talk about bispecifics all the time with a CD3 immune bispecific. This is not that, and I don't think you see the kind of CRS and tolerability issues. And the other thing is you have a PD-1 agent, but tislelizumab has been, you know, sort of, maybe you want to comment on the mechanism of both. It seems like the mechanism with tislelizumab is a little bit different from some of the other PD-1 agents. I guess right now we don't know what that means clinically. But any comments about sort of the biology behind this trial?
Well, the biology is to try to block in a better way with a bispecific antibody than with trastuzumab the HER2 pathway and the relevance. So to go for versus chemo plus zanidatamab. And then also because of the KEYNOTE-811 study that was updated at ESMO last weekend and published this weekend in The Lancet, the additional effect of a checkpoint inhibitor plus an HER2 antibody, that's why this was integrated in the arm C that you see here in the third arm. Tisley is a newer PD antibody, quite similar to Nivo and Pembro, but it has the company claims, and there are some data on that also. It's not only a claim, but there are some data that it's also having an ADC effect. But as you said rightly, we don't know what whether this translates in clinical superiority. There was never a head-to-head comparison of Tesli versus Nevo or versus Pembro. If you look in the cross-trial comparisons, Tesli, Pembro, Nevo in upper GI cancer, there is probably not a big difference in this setting between the three agents in this regard.
Yeah, and of course, we saw the data presented at ESMO on this first-line RATIONALE 305 study. And again, as you're saying, it kind of looks like what you see with other PD-1 inhibitors. That was your take on these new data as well?
Correct. And we have seen also data. We have seen data in, that you just showed a moment ago in stomach cancer. In the past, we have seen data with Tisley in second-line squamous cell cancer of the esophagus, and also in first-line squamous cell chemo plus or minus Tisley, which showed a benefit also in the different subgroups of patients. Probably quite similar to Pembro and Nevo again in this, also in this vital cancer.
So let's jump into some real-world cases and questions that come up in practice. We're going to start out with a patient of Dr. Rudolph, a 53-year-old woman, status post neoadjuvant therapy with a cross regimen for GEJ adenocarcinoma, goes to surgery, receives adjuvant Nevo, and while receiving adjuvant Nevo, develops a local recurrence. Here's Dr. Rudolph's questions.
This is a sad case. She's a 53-year-old female who was diagnosed with a GE junction adenocarcinoma. She has local recurrence of her tumor, needing an esophageal stent. She can't swallow. So I started her on treatment with FOLFOX, and she could not tolerate it. I did talk to her about considering paclitaxel with ramucirumab, which she's open to. My question is there a role for ctDNA? Could we have detected all this a lot sooner and maybe switched her to the metastatic treatment much earlier? Would that have made a difference? And I ask that because there is well known that these patients, once they progress fast, and there's very little you can do to get them back in any reasonable shape to do any more treatments. Second question for me that comes up is the use of zolbituximab, which hopefully will get approved soon. However, on the SPOTLIGHT trial was for first-line treatment with FOLFOX, but I'd be curious to know what people think of the efficacy compared to chemo with IO. Also, is there any data looking at zolbituximab in the second-line settings with someone like her?
So lots of questions. This is like you're on rounds and people are throwing you 20 questions at once, right? So any thoughts?
lots of questions, difficult questions. I think in theory, it can be true what you say, what you ask about circulating DNA, whether we can discover it recurrence earlier. Probably yes. Formally speaking, we don't have the data yet in upper GI cancer that it's the case, but mechanistically it's probably true. In pancreatic cancer, maybe a bit more difficult according to our experience, but in stomach cancer, probably yes, you can detect it earlier. The next question, and that's even the more relevant question for the patient, is that if you would have detected the relapse 2 months earlier, would it have be important? Probably yes also, but not in all patients, but probably some patients. This patient, if I understand it well, was suffering a lot from dysphagia and problems because of the local recurrence. If that could be avoided by giving a bit more early the treatment, yes, potentially it could have been influenced. But of course, we don't have the data to defend that. But I think that the thinking and are very good and very relevant. Your second group of questions was regarding zolbetuximab. So obinutuzumab, what I remember from the whole bunch of questions is what you asked is whether there are any data in second line. No, until now, obinutuzumab. So obinutuzumab, for those less familiar with it, is a Claudin 18.2 antibody. Claudin 18.2 is positive in around 1 out of 3 of the patients. The trial was designed, there were 2 trials of chemo plus or minus obinutuzumab in Claudin 18.2 positive patients. That's a spotlight study, which was FOLFOX plus or minus. And then the GLOW is CAPOX plus or minus obinutuzumab, similar designs. Both studies reported in the first line treatment, see there the survival difference, a clear benefit in survival. And as Neil said, indeed, if you look at the relative benefit, quite similar to what we presented with the TOGA study. Of course, TOGA was pivotal. This was the very first study. Now we have a bit more studies in different subgroups. You asked the question also combining chemo plus checkpoint combining zolbetuximab plus checkpoint inhibition. This is a very, very important question. We know that around 1 out of 3 of the patients are Claudin positive, depending where you put the cutoff, but 40 to 50% of patients are PDL CPS positive. There is for sure a little bit overlap in this setting. Some of the Claudin patients have a slight positive PDL CPS score. And now there have some studies started to combine Claudin antibodies with checkpoint inhibitor, with chemo in this group of patients. So that opens this positive Claudin studies with zolbetuximab, opens a whole bunch of new studies and understanding. There is probably not so much overlap between Claudin 18.2 and HER2. The studies, the Claudin 18.2 studies with zolbetuximab were done in HER2 negative patients. There may be some overlap. We don't know exactly how much it is, but if there is overlap, it's quite limited between HER2 and Claudin. So in the future, we will have to take into, once approved, we will have to take into consideration Claudin 18.2 as a fourth biomarker, I would say, in upper GI cancer after HER2, MSI high, PDL CPS, and Claudin is, once approved, we will have to do that marker.
I guess FGFR maybe someday. You could be like 5 mark. You're going to be like lung cancer soon when you think about TOGA.
Yeah, that's coming after. Yes, there are some studies with FGFR antibodies. Bemarituzumab is the one that is most advanced. Zef Weinberg has presented a phase 2 study in FGFR positive patients based on immunochemistry. At the moment, 2 phase 3 studies are running with chemo plus or minus bemarituzumab or chemo nivo plus or minus bemarituzumab. So that's still a little bit further down the road, but if these phase 3 studies are positive, this will be indeed the 5th biomarker.
So what about her question concerning second line? Imagine a situation where the drug is approved. It's approved as first line therapy, but now she's got a patient who's very ill, is desperate, is run out of, you know, approved options. Would you consider it in second line if you could access it?
Well, the patient, the specific patient depends on how much time she relapsed after. So formally speaking, it's indeed second line. She relapsed, if I understood it well, during Nevo treatment. So if you consider that as a first line, if this patient would have been Claudin positive, having a relapse under Nevo, if PDL CPS was strong positive, I would treat the patient with chemo plus Nevo. If the patient was PDL CPS negative but Claudin positive, I would consider that because it was a progression on adjuvant Nevo in this setting. In strict second line, I would not recommend that today. Strict second line, meaning a patient being treated with FOLFOX or CAPOX with or without Nevo in first line, and then having a relapse on this, we would never consider of continuing FOLFOX or CAPOX than with zolbetuximab? We don't have any data of zolbetuximab plus the standard second line paclitaxel ramucirumab. So there are no data in this setting. There are no data with zolbetuximab plus FOLFIRI. So in strict second line, I don't think we can consider and we can advise that today.
One other thing about zolbetuximab, you know, oncologists, you know, they wake up in the morning, they check their phone, and all of a sudden something's approved. And one of the things I'm wondering about is if and when this agent is approved, I'm curious to hear more about the GI toxicity, because so many things in oncology cause nausea and vomiting. But this, the stories I'm hearing are a little bit different because this is, I guess, an on-target effect. So can you give me more of a feel for like how this compares to, let's say, the nausea and vomiting you see with chemotherapy, the timing, the intensity, treatment, et cetera?
Yeah, it's indeed, as you said rightly, a non-target toxicity. Claudin 18.2 is present in the tight junction in the stomach. It binds to this on the tumor, but also in the stomach, so it gives some nausea and vomiting. The nausea and vomiting is not nothing. It's quite relevant in patients, but that's a toxicity we can manage. And the beauty, the nice thing for this is that it's most present in the beginning of the treatment, so the first and second cycle. When patients go over it, maybe also because we adapt the antiemetic strategy, but also I have the impression, and that's also the impression of my colleagues, that it improves. Is it because patients get used to it? I don't know, but it improves from cycle 3 onwards. But cycle 1 and 2, it's quite relevant, so strong antiemetics are needed for these patients.
All right, let's go to another case. And this is something that people ask all the time about the last, ever since the IO data started to come out, people are asking about what about gastric carcinoma and that same strategy. And finally, we saw, to me, like some pretty cool data that ESMO, I don't know if it's going to change practice or get approved, but at least we saw something there that I want to ask you about. But first, let's hear about this case from Dr. Zhu, a 67-year-old man.
This is a gentleman presented with abdominal pain and EGD showing a distal esophageal GE junction mass. Eventually, he was diagnosed with early stage GE junction adenocarcinoma. Based on the EGD, it was classified as a sideward class 3, moderately differentiated clinical T3 and 0, with no distant metastasis on the PET scan. We gave the patient the perioperative FLOT chemo regimen, and the patient did amazingly well. Actually, my question was mainly two. I've heard some tertiary centers are trying to push the chemotherapy all the way before the surgery. Is this the expert panel would in general recommend? How do they make their decisions to push 8 cycles of chemo beforehand versus 4 and 4 that was done on a clinical study? And my other question is that GE junction cancer sometimes is tricky to decide whether or not to use new adjuvant chemo versus new adjuvant chemo radiation. My approach usually is that if it's a sideward class 1, I go mostly with esophageal cancer and use new adjuvant chemo radiation. If it's sideward class 3, I go along with the gastric cancer management. But how do we manage something in between? How do the expert panel decide, you know, between the chemo radiation versus chemotherapy?
So her questions are really about what you're doing today. And I'm also going to ask what you think we might be doing in a year or two. But first of all, what about her questions?
Yeah, what we do today is a bit like what you do. We do in Leuven for the Siever type 1. So the tumors extend more to the esophagus. We give indeed a cross type of regimen with carboplatin plus radiotherapy. The Siever type 3, I do always perioperative FLOT. We do it before and after the operation. There was recently at ESMO GI in June a study presented also on an analysis, looking at what is the contribution of postoperative chemo. The postoperative chemo contributed to that. So I would still favor really perioperative and not pushing everything up front in this regard. The Sievert type 2, that's a difficult question. We have seen a study from Ireland and the UK presented in the past looking at in all G-junction tumors, Sievert type 1, 2, 3, perioperative chemo or preoperative chemoradiotherapy. There was no difference in outcome, so you cannot say that one sticks over the other. That's why in Sievert type 1 and Sievert type 3, we do what I said. In Sievert type 2, what we do usually is if it's a big tumor, a T4 tumor, without a lot of lymph nodes, regional lymph nodes, then I go usually for chemoradiotherapy because I have the impression, and that's also shown in some of the studies, that this may lead to a higher chance of R0 resection. If, however, the Sievert type 2, and I know it's not always easy to classify these tumors in 1, 2, 3, but the Sievert type 2 is not a big T4, but is a T2, T3 tumor, which seems resectable, but with a lot of lymph nodes. I would rather go, but that's more gut feelings, go for chemo. And in this group of patients, I give FLOT. So I try to individualize a little bit the approach because there is not one standard. There are two options for these patients. That's why I do individualize the treatment in these patients.
So the big question everybody has is we've seen IOs get integrated into esophageal cancer post-cross. People want to know, what about gastric adenocarcinoma? Are IOs going to be part of that? And I'm curious what your thoughts are in general, but also about this paper just presented at ESMO, the Matterhorn study, looking at adding in an IO durvalumab to neoadjuvant therapy. And at this point, I guess they're just reporting PATHCR, which looks pretty good. Looks like it's better, but any thoughts?
Yeah, correct. There were indeed two studies, this one and then there's another one. This full disclosure, I'm involved in both studies. This is a Matterhorn study, which was perioperative FLOT plus or minus Durva. And then after the operation, patients went on with Durva. We don't have yet any results of this study on long-term outcomes, event-free survival, disease-free survival, survival. So we don't have yet anything. But if you look at it, and as you can see here on this slide, there was indeed almost a doubling in the objective response rate. There was an increase. This is a near complete pathologic response rate. We reported also a clear increase in the pathologic complete response rate. Whether that's going to translate in event-free survival, so lower recurrence rate, in other words, we don't know. We are optimistic, but again, we don't have yet the data. Why we are optimistic is that because the other study, Keynote 585, which was presented, was a similar type of study. That study started a bit longer ago. That's why some patients received only a doublet of chemo, not a triplet of FLOT. There was a cohort of FLOT. And this study was a randomization chemo, doublet or triplet, plus Pembro or plus placebo in this Keynote 585. And Keynote 585 reported also a higher pathologic complete response rate, probably quite similar in range, but they reported to numerically improved event-free survival, but no significance. Just with a few patients, just missed the primary endpoint, Keynote 585, but the study was negative. So there was no benefit if you look at all comers, and patients could be included in as well Matterhorn as Keynote, regardless of PDL status. So all comers were treated. We need a bit more information on what's going to be the fate and the effect in PD-L1 positive tumors in this setting. So there is still a lot of ongoing work. I'm sure that within 1 year or two, within 1 or 2 years from now, we will see clear. And that maybe in a subgroup of patients, we will use FLOT plus a checkpoint inhibitor in this setting, durvalumab, if this study reads out positive on events and on disease-free survival.
And we're actually seeing some very similar things that maybe a year or two ahead of you in non-small cell lung cancer. We're seeing a lot of neoadjuvant chemo-IO being used. And actually, the path CR difference is not in lung is not that much different than what you all are seeing. So kind of seems like in the same ballpark. So I think we can go to another case. This is an elderly patient, 92 years old, but in very good condition, a patient of Dr. Polkinghorne. Actually, before we do that, a comment in the or question in the chat room, Eric, from Kamal, who says that his surgeons are now avoiding doing surgery in patients who have PET negativity after chemo radiation and negative esophageal biopsy. Any thoughts?
That's a difficult question. In MSS patients, I would not yet refrain from surgery in this setting, because PET negative scan doesn't mean always. We have published on this 15 years ago when one of my PhD co-workers was looking into that on the additional value. A negative PET CT doesn't always predict a complete pathologic response. I understand that negative PET CT with a negative endoscopy increases the likelihood in this setting. But we, in our policy, we are still quite surgically minded. If the patient is fit, at least in a fit patient, we would go often with still surgery in these patients, unless it's a very high localized tumor where the operation leads to high morbidity for a squamous cell cancer close to the musculus cricopharyngeus, where you have to do a laryngopharyngectomy. Of course, in these patients, you want to avoid surgery. Or unless the patient was not fit, an 85-year-old patient with comorbidity, of course we would stop after chemoradiotherapy if a complete response was obtained on PET and endoscopy.
So getting back to our 92-year-old woman who was initially treated for her esophageal squamous cell with just radiation therapy and now has local recurrence. And interestingly, her PD-L1 level is 71. Here's the case.
So this is a remarkable woman, very fit at 92, presented about 18 months ago with dysphagia. She had endoscopy and, in fact, was found to have squamous cell carcinoma. We, in good discussion with our radiation therapist, felt that this very localized disease might do well with radiation therapy alone, and she was hoping to avoid concomitant chemotherapy with that. And so she was treated with radiation. It was quite successful. Her esophagus was better. She's had one or two dilations since then by GI, but more recently developed dysphagia. And this time, at the time of EGD, she was in fact found to have squamous cell carcinoma locally recurrent. We did a PET CT, which showed a very significant avid area in that area of the esophagus, but no other evidence of disease. But her CPS score was high. And my question is, in a 92-year-old who would not be a great candidate for chemotherapy, would pembrolizumab be a reasonable intervention, which is what I'm thinking of for her, and how often that is used in this setting of localized disease? And I'm hoping that it'll get approved if, in fact, our investigators think this is a reasonable option for a 92-year-old.
And, of course, there are different diseases, but, you know, we see five-year survivals with high PD-1 levels of patients getting with lung cancer, of patients who get PD-1 alone. I don't know if there are any data on this level of PD-1 and response to monotherapy. Do they respond?
I think the patient has a high chance of response, no guarantee. I think there could be a couple of options. Indeed, that's Nevo alone. We don't have a lot of data in this regard. If you look at one of the CheckMate studies, 648, this was a study also where there was an arm of Nevo plus EP. Of course, Nevo plus EP leads is a bit more heavy in a 92 years old patient, but that could also be a consideration in this. If you judge the patient is it's really 92, but still fit. Then Nevo alone, and not good enough, let's say, for Nevo plus chemo or Nevo plus EP, Nevo alone could be an option. What I would consider also is looking at, I may have missed it, but at which level the tumor was and the stenosis and the recurrence, how far was it from the cricopharyngeal? If there was a couple of centimeters below the cricopharyngeal in a patient with a lot of dysphagia, I think you could consider also putting in a stent and then starting Nevo, because the resolution of the dysphagia will be much faster when you can put in a stent, an esophageal stent in this patient. So that's something I would consider for sure also in a 92-year-old patient, a stent and then probably Nevo alone. Or if really, really fit and the patient was a fighter, Nevo plus EP.
So I want to get to HER2-positive disease, but one other question. It just sort of flashed into my head as we got started here tonight, which I never thought to really ask anybody, which is your sense about the responsiveness in general. I mean, honestly, IOs and upper GI cancer is not that easy to understand, at least for me. Maybe it's just me, but I find it confusing. So let me just ask you a general question. Do you think that esophageal squamous cell cancer in general, if you match PD-1 level to PD-1, TMB, whatever, is similar to what you see with gastric adenocarcinoma? Or do you think that esophageal squamous cell, in general, you see more responses to IOs?
You see quite a lot of responses, that's quite consistent in the different studies. The data on PD-L, PD-L CPS scoring, it's far from perfect biomarker, but it's the best that we do have. In Europe also, the EMA has taken an approach that Pembro is approved for patients with esophageal cancer with a PD-L CPS positive tumor. So it's not a very broad label. The data with Nevo also were for the PD-L positive patients. So this is probably a biomarker. And in squamous cell tumors, also the second line studies where Nevo, which were positive for Nevo, which were positive for tislelizumab, and which showed a trend for a benefit with Pembro in second line esophageal cancer, really showed that in esophageal cancer, although a difficult disease in this drinkers and smokers sometimes, like the head and neck cancer patients, but checkpoint inhibitors are active in this setting, and that's in fact the only new drug that we have since long time in esophageal cancer.
So let's go to another case, and it's interesting that a 67-year-old man who presented with a GE junction adenocarcinoma that was HER2 negative, but then developed oligometastatic disease. We were just talking about oligometastatic disease that was HER2 positive. Here's the case.
This is a 67-year-old gentleman with a gastroesophageal junction adenocarcinoma and biopsy-proven oligometastases to bone with a HER2 negative primary, but a HER2 positive 3+ by IHC metastasis, who presents with inability to take PO and profound weight loss. How would you prioritize local regional versus systemic therapy for this gentleman? What approved regimen would you use for systemic therapy given discrepant HER2 results between the primary and the metastatic lesion?
So what's happened with this patient?
This patient's dysphagia and obstructive symptoms were quite prominent, and he also had oligometastasis, which is to say his two metastatic lesions were quite small and limited to two only. For that reason, it was felt safe to proceed with chemoradiation to prioritize local regional control. After he rests for a few weeks to recover, a KEYNOTE-811 regimen is going to be started. And that regimen is chemotherapy backbone, trastuzumab, and pembrolizumab.
And we'll talk about the history of 811, because I think this was during the period when we were giving pembro with PD-1 negative, because I don't think he even had a PD-1 on this. But in any event, first, any thoughts about the case?
Yeah, we would go for the approach of starting with chemo and not chemo radiotherapy in such a patient. I do understand completely. You can defend it that you start with chemo radiotherapy. But on the other hand, we know you can start usually faster with chemo. And we know that at least 50% of patients will have quite soon after one or maximum two cycles an improvement of the dysphagia in the setting. We would therefore start with systemic treatment. The patient has spread disease, although oligometastatic, but has circulating tumor cells. We would start with systemic treatment. And then if the patient, and then there may be two scenarios later on, either the patient doesn't respond, then in the second line, we may go before we start the second line treatment for radiotherapy. Or if the patient has a deep, deep response on chemo, as an improvement in the primary tumor, but not a complete disappearance, then later on, you may consider doing that. But in the first step, we would consider always starting systemic treatment in this patient. The question on primary tumor or two negative, the metastasis positive, that indeed shows what I indicated earlier, that gastric cancer, it's not always heterogeneous. It's always even different biopsies in the primary tumor may show discordant results. That's why there is a recommendation of to take at least 6 or 8 endoscopic biopsies in these tumors to have the chance of finding HER2 positivity bigger. If you would have a patient like this with a primary tumor that is HER2 negative, but the metastasis proven clearly HER2 positive, according to criteria, then indeed we would go for HER2 targeted therapies in this patient.
So you mentioned a big paper that was just presented at the ESMO, one of the biggest papers there with the follow-up from the KEYNOTE-811 study. Of course, originally this strategy of adding on pembro to your TOGA regimen was approved regardless of PD-1. At that point, I think there were only 50 patients and 85% of them were PD-1 positive. But now in ESMO, they're presenting, I think, like 700 patients. And here, you can clearly see in the forest plot that there's no benefit, although it's still a fairly small number of patients, I think like 100 patients or so. But obviously, it's sticking right there on the hazard rate of 1. So I guess that changes the use of pembro in this situation. Anything else you want to say about first-line therapy? Do you generally use the 811 regimen, assuming the PD-1 level is positive? And what's your experience with tolerability?
Well, I've used it in a couple of patients only because it was not approved until recently. It's not yet reimbursed. It will come now with these positive data. Tolerance is okay. I think the data that we presented at ESMO are important. Indeed, patients need to have a PD-L positive tumor. Around 15%, 15 to 20% are PD-L negative. In the HER2 positive, PD-L negative, we will never add pembro. But in those who are positive for HER2 and PD-L, we will add pembrolizumab to trastuzumab in this setting.
So let's do another case. This is a patient who is HER2 positive, also has a elevated CPS of 10. This patient presented with metastatic disease, was actually initially treated with the TOGA-like regimen, and now has progression. Here's Dr. Malik.
7-year-old woman. This was a patient who presented also with dysphagia. We did a PET scan. She had metastatic gastroesophageal cancer. She had liver metastases. She was HER2 positive, so she received upfront treatment with 5-FU oxaliplatinum and trastuzumab. She was on treatment for approximately 1 year, and then progressed. Her PD-L1 score came back positive, combined 15%. So with FAM trastuzumab in the treatment paradigm, you know, what is the best treatment option for her in second line therapy? Should we go to 5-fluorouracil with irinotecan and add in an immunotherapy agent, or should we try FAM trastuzumab in this patient?
Have you used TDXD in other cases like breast cancer or lung cancer?
I have used it a lot in breast cancer.
And any questions you have for investigators about using it in a patient like this?
Sure. Number one is, yes, how do they manage the nausea? We have added significant pre-meds to our regimens for these patients. However, I think even if the nausea is under control, with most of my patients, they do have a decreased appetite and weight loss on this medication. A lot of times there's multiple agents I try with these patients, olanzapine. We give them emend up front, and they say the nausea is controlled, but they still tend to have weight loss.
Interesting.
I see that quite a bit.
So, you know, you hear different things when you talk to people. I haven't heard that particular thought, but I don't know. You tell me. First of all, any thoughts about choosing second line therapy, where TDXD fits in? And also this thing, again, that I haven't heard anybody else. I've heard a lot about GI toxicity, but she's saying she thinks she sees more than that in terms of anorexia, even if you control the nausea. Any thoughts?
Yeah, that's not really my experience. In this typical patient, I would indeed also go for TDX, trastuzumab deruxtecan, the antibody drug conjugate. We published recently in the Lancet Oncology the phase 2 study in Western patients showing a clear benefit. In this study, GI toxicity, there is GI toxicity, that's clear. But that's feasible. The nausea, vomiting, in my experience, was a bit less than with solbituximab, what we discussed earlier. What we found, and that's also, I've seen it also, is that we see in some patients ILD around 10% across different indications, also in stomach cancer, and then you have to stop. Trastuzumab deruxtecan is a cytotoxic. There is a cytotoxic active drug in this, so it leads to some toxicity. But there is a benefit also. We showed around 40% of patients have an objective response in this study. So it's an active drug. We could manage it, at least in our patients.
And as you mentioned, you did see pneumonitis there. We're going to go in a second to the survey, but I'm just kind of curious in general, what will allow you to reach? You have a patient who's getting TDXD, they're responding, they have ILD, they get treated, corticosteroids, it resolves. In what situations will you re-challenge the patient with TDXD in breast? They say if it was grade 1, no symptoms, they'll rechallenge. But if there's symptoms, they don't. Do you use the same approach?
Yes, we use completely the same approach. I think we have to be quite strict with this. What we don't want to have is a grade 4 or a grade 5. We don't want to lose patients. So we have a strict approach. Grade 1, indeed, without symptoms, we would rechallenge. Grade 2, with symptoms, we would not rechallenge. Then we stop the agent.
All right, let's take a look at some of the survey questions that we asked the faculty just to kind of see what they're doing in their practices. We know there are often a number of evidence-based options that we have to consider. What we're interested in is what people usually do, understanding that, of course, you have to individualize to the patient. When we see everybody answering the same way, we say, oh, that sounds like a consensus. We see three or four different answers. We know there's controversy. So I'll say for the source one, it looks like there's consensus about the use of post-cross residual disease nivolumab for a year with PD-1 not affecting it very much. Any thoughts for that?
Yeah, it's indeed correct. It's a little bit counterintuitive with what we told earlier, that PD-L CPS is a biomarker. in this study, the adjuvant study with Nivo, it was not shown to be the case. The study was also initially powered for all comers. The study started before we had these recent studies. So in this situation, that's also within the label. We use Nivo regardless of the PD-L positive, and that's what five out of the six colleagues said.
Right. So this is kind of reminds me of the 92-year-old case we were talking about. This patient who was actually this patient got chemo radiation, but didn't go wasn't considered a candidate for surgery. And the question we put out there is, would you consider a PD-1 agent, even though again this patient didn't have surgery? Most of the faculty says no, except one that says yes. What are your thoughts in terms of this? It looks like even if the PD-1 is high, you're not going to do it.
The patient, that's correct. I think, in this setting, there was a relapse. I'm just looking at the case, trying to understand the case.
No, it's just residual disease.
Residual disease in this setting. That was not within the criteria of the study. So we would not do it as 5 out of 6 if there was residual disease. The adjuvant Nivo was for patients who had a complete resection without residual disease.
So another thing we're kind of curious about is MSI high gastroesophageal cancer. We asked about this situation in a patient with a gastric adenocarcinoma, gets pre-op FLOT, has a residual disease at surgery, but is found to be MSI high. And here everybody is talking about an IO. Any thoughts? Have you actually seen this happen? Have you had patients like this?
Yeah, I've had a few patients. They're not frequent. In this, that's only a few percent or MSI high. And then you have the specific situation, FLOT, significant residual disease. That's another. But I've seen it. I think in this MSI high patients, there was residual disease. They do respond a little bit less to chemo. They do respond to checkpoint inhibitor. So the best chance for these patients is to go for a checkpoint inhibitor. And there, I don't have any preference. Pembro and Nivo are quite similar in this setting.
And this is another question we asked in terms of MS high, in terms of whether people use it in a neoadjuvant situation. Of course, everybody got all excited with the Memorial report of rectal cancer with MSI high. With IO, and now we're seeing that with gastroesophageal and cancers. We asked, would you use an IO as part of neoadjuvant therapy in a patient with MSI high gastroesophageal cancer? Pretty much everybody says yes. Any thoughts?
Yes, I would say also clearly yes. We have seen data from an Italian study, from a French study, two different studies. One was published recently in the JCO that with a checkpoint inhibitor in MSI high tumors, you can obtain a good chance of having a complete response. The reason I put clinical T3, T4 is that in an early cancer, the T1, you could also defend surgery. That's still the standard today in this early cancer. If the patient is not fit, I would treat him or her also with checkpoint inhibitors.
So we also asked about the 8-11 type situation, the first line therapy. And again, I think everybody is now in agreement that we should not use Pembro with the TOGA regimen if the CPS is zero. Most people, other than one doc, says they would use it just as long as the CPS is greater than one. But I think where you see a lot of questions is about second-line therapy. Here it looks like most people are thinking about TDXD. But of course, ramucirumab plus paclitaxel also has activity in this situation. Can you talk about how you think this thing through, how you think through second line therapy, and in what situations, if any, would you think about something other than TDXD?
Well, there is still a randomized study ongoing, a large phase 3 study of trastuzumab deruxtecan versus ram-paclitaxel. That study is ongoing. That's probably why Sam Klemper put both options, because the study is ongoing. But in this setting, trastuzumab deruxtecan, as we discussed earlier, gives around 40% objective responses in HER2-positive patients. We love to do a targeted therapy, so that's why I would really go for trastuzumab deruxtecan in these patients.
And then when we say we get the same answers that we say first-line therapy included pembro, but and this is what we were just talking about before, the idea of discontinuation or re-challenge based on grade. And most people agree that grade 2 or symptomatic ILD, although Dr. Ajani seems a little bit more aggressive. What about HER2-low? I'm not sure how much data there is in gastroesophageal. Obviously, we're doing an entire symposium on HER2-low breast cancer in San Antonio. So much to talk about in breast cancer. What about HER2-low in gastroesophageal? Looks like not too much interest in that.
There are no large studies. That's clear. A second remark is HER2, as we discussed earlier, is probably less, it's relevant in stomach cancer, but probably less relevant compared to breast cancer, meaning with that also the heterogeneity, and it's probably less of a driver in this setting. So the chances that TDX would, or another drug would work in the HER2-low are clearly lower than in breast cancer. That's why there was quite a consensus in this setting, I guess.
So we were talking before about zolbetuximab, and we asked the investigators how many patients they've actually treated with it. We asked them also, and you know, a lot of these survey things are in the chat room that we're not going to have time to talk about, but there's a lot of granularity to this survey. We asked a bunch of questions about the issue of Zolbe versus IO. So this is one of them where we say Claudin was positive, CPS was either 0 or 1. I can understand the 0, but it's interesting when people say they still stick with zolbetuximab CPS of 1. Any comments? Of course, this is theoretical, assuming it gets approved.
Yeah, in Europe, Nivo is only approved for PD-L CPS 5. If you would have written there 5, I would have said Nivo probably. Recently, we have seen Keynote 859 study with chemo plus or minus pembro, which was positive for PD-L CPS 1. But if Claudin was positive today with this, I would still go for zolbetuximab. In the future, if we have the data on in the CPS 1 of zolbetuximab plus pembro or nivo, that may be a treatment of the future. But that's a little bit too early to combine it yet.
And here is that scenario you're just talking about where the CPS is 10, and now you're saying IO, which makes sense. Yeah, these are some of the comments we got about some of the experiences that people have had with zolbetuximab in terms of GI toxicity. So one final issue, we've asked this in a variety of solid tumors, which is, first of all, do you think that PD-1 antibodies in general and GE cancer look pretty similar? I think you already said that they do, and most people do, although Dr. Enziger, I guess, thinks that maybe there's a little bit of a difference in terms of a gastric cancer. And this is a really interesting one, which is, if you believe that, what would you do if one of them was priced lower than the other? Any thoughts about that? And it seems like people would say, yeah.
Yeah, Europe...
Not that that's going to happen.
Yeah, I think that's important. In Europe, if there would be a different, an important difference in price, the authorities would influence or change the reimbursement, could change the reimbursement criteria. So this is an important driver for decision, for sure. In Europe, where we have to look in resources, maybe in the US you have unlimited resources sometimes, but in Europe we have to take that into account for sure.
So, Eric, thank you so much for working with us today. It's always a pleasure to work with you. Audience, thank you for attending. Coming back on November 7th, we're going to start our post-ESMO series focusing on gynecologic cancers. A bunch of things that happened were really interesting. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Eric.
Thank you very much, Neil. Nice talking to you, as always.